trust. It's the people in charge we're not sure about.
Episode 25. Live long and prosper, everybody. So, some sad news this week in the passing away of Leonard Nimoy, Dr. Spock from Star Trek. Genuinely, right, I think, one of the great people from the science and the tech world. I know he's probably, well, obviously, he's mainly known for playing Dr. Spock in Star Trek, the original series, and all of the different films that spun out of that. But I know he was also a really big supporter of science and technology. Well, sadly, he's boldly gone where one day all of us will go. Guys, Mark and Hans, I don't know if he particularly influenced your lives at all. I know he did, and definitely Star Trek the franchise massively influenced the way I got into technology. And I can share a quick story about that in a second. But
oh, I can't wait to hear that. I've always kind of thought you were a Spock-like guy anyway, Nigel.
I'm not sure how to take that.
Well, you know, when somebody says, so what's Nigel like? I should say, well, he's kind of Spockish.
Oh, yeah, very good, yeah. No, so let me tell you real quick then. I don't know, when I was about like 16 or 17, every Wednesday night in the UK, there'd be an episode of Star Trek on. Sometimes it was the original series and sometimes it was The Next Generation. And I think it played at like 6 o'clock till about 6:45. And what I would do, I had this routine every week where I'd watch an episode of Star Trek after having my tea. And then I'd go to a night class where I was learning to program C. And it was just... this is going to sound really geeky, okay? But it was what, like, kind of built me up and inspired me to go on out to the night class and learn C, because I just used to love, like, all the technology and stuff that was on display. And honestly, it really, like, my Wednesday night ritual, have my tea, watch a bit of Star Trek, go and program some C. I mean, how's about that for getting somebody into technology?
It's awesome. I've never heard anyone say that Spock inspired him to learn C.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I didn't end up really learning C. So I did it for about 6 months, and I used to live in quite a rough area, actually, and my family couldn't afford a car. So I would walk to the night class, and then when I would come out, it would be dark, and there'd be like gangs of kids and stuff around the streets, and particularly on a couple of street corners. And I just got to the point where, as much as Star Trek would pump me up and I would like going to the class and learning, it was just too much of a health hazard having to walk home on my own afterwards and like take detours to avoid these groups of kids and stuff. And I genuinely...
So you didn't have a phaser you could set to stun?
You know what? This is going to sound even worse. I did used to think things like, you know, a phaser or like the Vulcan death grip or something. But being genuine, I put that down, I think, as one of the...
How about beaming yourself up to the classroom?
You know what? That never crossed my mind, but that is even better. But I put it down as one of the big mistakes of my life, really, not continuing on in that night class. And I think when I look, but you know, sometimes you look back on your life and you think, you know, when I was at school, if I'd stuck in a bit harder or if I'd just done something else, my career or my life would be different. I genuinely do look back at that time of my life and think, you know what, if I know what I know now about my career and stuff, I really would have stuck that out. But I was really sad to hear that he died. I mean, look, we all die at the end of the day, and he's lived a long and prosperous life. I don't want that to sound too corny. But I really appreciated his life, and the whole Star Trek thing really was quite significant for me as a kid.
Yeah, I was sad too last week when I heard it. He seems like really such a good guy. I don't know much about Leonard Nimoy other than what I read afterwards, and the tributes to him and, you know, his stories were all very positive. What do they call it? The stuff that they write, you know, the obituaries. The obits were very, very positive for Leonard Nimoy. But, you know, the thing that's interesting about it is, like, he was so closely linked to his character, Spock. You know, when Leonard Nimoy dies, it's like Spock died.
Yeah.
Well, actually, there's this young guy, you know, that plays Spock now in the new movies. He's quite good at it.
Oh, he's very
Spock's
good.
Not dead. Oh, that guy's great. I love him. I can't remember his name, though. Not like Leonard Nimoy. You know, do you know the name of the guy who's playing Spock now?
No, I don't know.
I mean, isn't that the thing, right?
Yeah.
So Leonard Nimoy, you'll always associate with that. And was such a great character, right? I know, and, you know, so for me growing up as a little kid, you know, you do pretend things and you're like, you pretend you're the guys in the show. You go outside and you play, right? And,
yeah,
you know, some guy's Kirk and some guy's a Klingon, you know? There's always a couple of guys that want to be Spock and only one guy could, you know, I want to be Spock. No, I want to be Spock. Well, I don't want to be Spock's dad. You know, I don't want to be, I don't want to, nobody else wanted to be any other Vulcans or anything, right?
And yeah.
Spock was the interesting guy because he's like Superman.
You
know,
oh, yeah.
You could punch him and he wouldn't get hurt. You know, he was super strong when he needed to be. I mean, you know, he could lift like a car or something. You know, he could lift rocks and he was
Vulcan
smarter
death
than every
grip, yeah.
Oh God, the best. How many times have I wanted that?
How many times did you try that as a kid, I bet?
Yeah. Or how many times did I try it on my kids?
Yeah. Did you ever try a mind meld?
I took acid.
I'm not sure that's
not the same.
Not
the same thing. Yeah, I ate mushrooms. Yeah. No, I never tried the mind meld. Did you?
Yes, I did try. You know, I'm far too cool to have ever tried that. But yeah, I tried the mind meld. Yeah.
Yeah.
How did it work out? When I was younger.
Uh huh.
I was obviously super cool as a youngster, you can tell, yeah?
Oh, I bet. Yeah, I'm sure. You know, so I really thought it was sweet how in his last movie, right, he plays the old Spock. There's the two Spocks, right, from different times, right? And he goes through a wormhole, and the two of them coexist, and they see each other, like in the hangar with the craft there, right? Or the, you know, the spaceships.
That's right, yeah.
And I loved the departure scene. And there were many, many great scenes with Spock, but there was just something really, it was really kind of touching about it because I watched this the day he died, actually.
Oh, right.
And so it was in a very interesting, emotional thing. You know, I don't know if it was the FX channel or something, just if they happened to be showing it or they put it on because it was the day Leonard Nimoy died. And when Spock is leaving, when old Spock is leaving younger Spock, he gives him the, you know, the hand gesture, which is an old Jewish or Yiddish thing, apparently.
All right.
You know, and he says, I won't say what I normally do because it would be self-serving. And I just thought there was something very sweet about that, very honest and sweet. And it was kind of like Leonard Nimoy saying, you know, bye.
Yeah. Uh-huh. You know what? I think my favorite scene of him from any of the shows or any of the movies, I don't know if you remember it, but in Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, where they're going looking for those humpback whales, and they go back in time and they dress up in these funky outfits, and they're in, like, I don't know, New York or Chicago. No, was it San Francisco, actually?
I think San Francisco.
Yeah. So they're in San Francisco. And at one point, he dives in to the pool where this whale is, and he mind melds with the whale.
Yes.
Legendary.
Yes. That's an awesome scene.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, so a great guy. Sad that he's passed away, but been very, very influential. And you know what? There's no better way to live your life, I don't think, than being able to be a great person and influence people. So thank you, Leonard Nimoy, for your life, and best of wishes to all of your family and friends. Shall we move on, though? It's just the three of us this week, so thanks to Luca Dell'Oca, we are deprived of the Rickatron this week, and due to some flight scheduling, there's no Gabriel either.
What are we going to do?
We don't have background noises.
Oh, what the heck? So we can't have a party then? Okay, so a few things before we take a look at some stuff just tidying up from last week's show. Hans, I know a couple of things that you want to talk about. First up, vSphereLand is running its annual poll of top VMware and virtualization blogs. What have you got to say on that?
Well, apparently, and I don't think we did it ourselves, but we are in the list of the favorite podcasts, so it would be great if our listeners went through the survey and clicked our name, of course.
Hey now!
We'll put the link in the show notes. We already got some nice love on the Twitters today from people that said, well, I voted for In Tech We Trust as favorite podcast, so thanks for that.
That is awesome. We really appreciate that.
vote often. Keep voting.
Yeah.
Yeah, and keep those love letters coming. Just for that, we have being 25 shows in. I think it's time we got some of the feedback from our listeners. So we made a survey, a very short couple of questions about topics and how we make the show.
More containers.
No, not at all. I think I will even scratch containers as a technology in general. There is one thing that just to make the survey worth doing is I added one question, what I always wanted to ask, ... So you can choose one of the hosts and ask a question. The funnier the questions, the better. And I will ask a couple of them next week on the show.
Cool. But a short and concise survey, yeah?
Yes. It's three or four questions with a couple of topics. Too much, just right, and add more. That's what we want to know from you. And, of course, just a blank box with personal feedback. The more, the merrier.
Magic. Like the sound of it.
Yes.
So have either of you guys been up to anything interesting recently? Hans, actually, I know that you're taking the old MacBook into the Apple store tomorrow, aren't you?
Yeah. There's been an issue with the MacBook's graphical card, so the MacBook Pro since 2011, and they're doing a global repair program. So they're not going to give you a new one, but they're doing a global repair on all MacBook Pros that fit that category of graphical cards. And I've had those issues with my graphical card, so I'm very much looking forward to getting that repaired.
So what are you going to do without it for like a week or two?
I'm not doing anything interesting at all. So besides,
he's going to do a Vulcan mind meld with it. He's just going to touch it.
Oh, jeez.
Upload all of that data.
Yes. I'm going to plug my USB 3 one terabyte disk into my nose.
Have you ever seen Johnny Mnemonic?
Send pictures,
Johnny
Mnemonic? Yeah. No. What, does he do that?
I haven't seen it, but a guy I used to work with talked to me about it all the time. You got to watch it. It's about apparently this guy. It was Johnny Depp, and his job is he's some form of like a data courier, and he couriers sensitive data around, but he doesn't carry it in a hard drive or anything. It gets plugged into him and uploaded to his head. And if he uploads too much data and stuff, he gets nosebleeds and things. I don't know. kind of a techie film. I haven't seen it, but I probably should.
Techie nosebleeds.
Yeah.
Is that MLC?
Who knows? You've been up to anything interesting, Mark?
Let's see. Tonight I'm getting together with Tony, my NASA friend who I brew beer with.
Your beer buddy.
My beer buddy. And it's been a while. It's been like a month since I've gone together with Tony. We're going to drink some beer. And strangely enough, I mean, we started this batch almost 6 weeks ago, I think, maybe 5 weeks ago. And he told me that one of the fermentation vessels is still fermenting, that one of the airlocks got jammed up, because gas was coming through, something happened to it, a little bit of fluid comes in there, and it just shocked. Because usually the fermentation's way done by now, so we'll be, checking the specific gravity of it and seeing how close it is to final. I mean, it should just about be done. And so I'm very excited. We made about 10 gallons, two different batches. It's this exact same beer, but we produced the wort differently.
Are you going to do some after fermentation in the bottles or not?
No, actually, with this batch, we'll do some bottle conditioning, but we've got small kegs, and so we're going to carbonate in those kegs. And this is the first time we've done that.
Okay.
So this is a Pilsner. It's been, fermenting at lower temperature, and I'm very excited. I mean, the last time I looked at it, it had great color. You know, it just had this really nice golden color. One of them, anyway, it's been very interesting watching the two of them side by side. And the difference, again, is how we just prepared the wort. One of them had a more involved preparation, doing things at different times and different temperatures, and the other one was just a big cook.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I'm excited about that. I mean, I can't do a mind meld with beer. Maybe I can. That's what I'll be doing tonight. Just putting my fingers on a fermentation jug, thinking beer.
You can attach it to one of those backpacks and just run tubes into your mouth, though. That's the equivalent, I think.
Yeah, or maybe just go into Homer Simpson mode,
Yeah. So you're obviously not bored of it yet, are you? You're still really excited? You're still learning a bunch with that, yeah?
Yeah, still learning a bunch. My son just turned 21, and about a month ago, you know, we had talked about maybe putting a batch of ale together for him so he could have a batch of ale on his 21st birthday. Well, that didn't happen.
Where did that getting bored question come from? How could you get bored of that?
No, you know what it is? It's like anything that's new, at least me, I run headlong into it, and it's really interesting, it's really new, and I'm learning tons of stuff. But I always get to this kind of point where I feel, you know what? Obviously, there's always still stuff to learn, but I've learned the majority of it. I've got a good understanding of it now, and I kind of like, okay, and then I start looking for the next thing. And I just wondered whether I'm not saying you're totally going to be bored of it or anything. Maybe it's something you'll do for the rest of your life, but have you got over that initial, like, oh, this is so cool yet?
You can't get over that just by getting a few batches out.
Right, it's a great mystery. I mean, no. So the answer is, Nigel, I'm kind of like Hans on this. It's still very interesting and intriguing. I haven't spent as much time doing it. I've been really busy. We've had weekend stuff, but I still want to make more beer. Yeah. It's disappointing to me that I've got the supplies to make another batch, and you know, I've had them in my office here for a couple of weeks, and I haven't brewed yet. That's disappointing, but
yeah, you know, there's hundreds of different types. I mean, you can. It's not like containers. You got a yellow container, you got a pink container, you got a blue container, and you're done.
It's not like containers. I'm glad you told me that.
Yeah. So Nigel, what about you? I mean, what have you been up to? What interesting tech things, you know, besides Spark? You know,
want to bet on containers?
Well, I just want to ask you guys one really quick question before I talk about what I've been doing recently. Just random question, right? Who knows the most about beer, Mark or Hans?
Oh, I think Hans does.
And he's not shouting you down on that. So, fair enough, yeah. Maybe you can make it a goal to know more than Hans one day.
Yeah, and I'm going to keep it secret until I do, and then I'm going to pounce.
Yeah.
And it's just going to be a beer attack.
Here's another question. Who's consumed the most out of the two of you?
I don't think there's Hans. A question there.
Yeah. Well, is that because of Mark's age?
No.
Oh, you were thinking had.
I'm quite a bit older. I think Hans has consumed quite a bit more than me. He's a bigger vessel.
The Hulk. Okay. So go on then. Let's.
I don't know. Actually, that's a really interesting concept. You know, if there was a way that you could like go in and have a somebody stick a needle in you, they could tell you how much beer you consume.
Stick a needle into your liver, they might be able to find out. Hey, you know all these your mum is so fat jokes that are out there, yeah?
Don't get me started.
I don't know if this works.
But, are we going there? Are we going there?
No, no. I once heard a joke about Hans that Hans drank so much that he cut himself and beer came out. That's terrible, isn't it?
Your mum's so fat she couldn't even fit in a container.
Hey!
Hey!
We'll pivot onto our more traditional technologies then. So, you asked what I'd done in the last week or so. So a bunch of stuff, right? But I did write a blog post about a product called Rancher OS by the guys at Rancher Labs. And I had a little exchange with Hans on our Slack channel before the show started. Basically, I just wrote this quick blog post saying, I reckon that, you know, the days of where a desktop and a server operating system were pretty much the same thing, except that the desktop version had like, I don't know, productivity apps and stuff installed on it, and the server operating system maybe had a DNS server on it or something. But at the core, they were exactly the same, yeah? I think, at least in the Linux world, right, those days are totally over. If you're into Linux, any of the listeners, and you're into, like, modern technologies like containers and stuff like that, I'd recommend you go out and check Rancher OS. Basically, I mean, I thought it was dead interesting. Just a quick background, like, you know that Android is obviously a Linux distro of sorts, but it's really totally different to something like Red Hat or Ubuntu. And we get that fact because, well, it's for a mobile device, right, rather than a desktop. But then the desktop and the server versions of Linux have really been pretty much the same, even though the difference between maybe a mobile phone and a desktop and a server and a desktop are the same. They're like all worlds apart. But we've just gone on with life, the fact that, oh yeah, a server's the same as a desktop almost. Well, in the Linux world, those days are pretty much over. So, I mean, Rancher OS is basically a kernel, and then everything in user space is implemented inside of a Docker container. So SSH, syslog, all that kind of stuff, all implemented inside of a container. And I just think we're about to see like a really almost a sea change in the world of Linux operating systems. And I know for you, Hans and Mark, it's not necessarily directly in your wheelhouse, but maybe it is for some of the listeners. So, you know, technologies like CoreOS and what have you have been making waves in the Linux server world over the last year or so. But something like Rancher OS really, in my opinion, takes it to another level by totally changing what a Linux server operating system looks like. And this isn't a cheap shot for my blog or anything, because it's probably a pretty crappy op. No, it's, I mean, look, I don't advertise on the blog site.
I just
site.
Love the way you sound sometimes. I know it's not. I just...
yeah, yeah. I don't advertise. I don't take any money from the blog or anything, so it don't really bother me if anybody reads it at the end of the day. But I know that some of the listeners are potentially interested in Linux, containers, cloud operating systems, stuff like that. If you're interested, go and have a look at Rancher OS from the guys at Rancher Labs. Yeah, can't even remember now. Really, really interesting product. And actually, bit of a weird name as well. And I reached out to the guys at Rancher Labs on Twitter saying, where did the name come from? And he's like, oh, well, it's... you know how they have this pets versus cattle analogy? He said, well, we're all about the beef. You know, we're all about cows.
Oh, yeah.
And,
yeah. Oh, yeah.
There you go. So if you're interested, go and check out Rancher OS from the guys at Rancher Labs. I think it's an interesting technology. I don't know if you guys have anything to say on that, by the way. Apologies for assuming that you wouldn't.
So where are they from? Where's Rancher OS? Are they English company? US
no,
company?
They're an American company. They're headquartered, I think, out of Silicon Valley, but they've got an office in maybe it's Phoenix, Arizona. It's definitely somewhere in Arizona. In fact, I don't know if there's anywhere else in Arizona other than Phoenix. Apologies for my US geography there. But they're a US-based company. And actually, the guys that founded the company have all got a strong heritage in I've forgotten the name of the technology now, but it was another startup that ended up getting acquired by Citrix a while ago. Oh, hell. Can't remember. Not to worry, though.
Looks like cloud.com.
Yeah. Hmm?
Looks like cloud.com.
Yes, yes. So, yeah. Yeah, they've got good heritage in startups in the past and what have you. Obviously, top Linux engineers and top startup guys there. I think it's an interesting product.
Yeah, very interesting. Yeah, their corporate headquarters is in Cupertino, about a mile and a half from where I am right now.
All right, okay.
And they have a lab in Tempe, Arizona. Interesting. So some of the team is there.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Cool. Okay.
An engineering team. That's a very interesting company. It looks like, you know, there's four coders that are putting this together.
And I love stuff like that, right?
Yeah, same here.
You know, proper techie guys with good ideas and trying to make good technology. Yeah, worth checking out.
Yeah, Rancher Labs.
Now then, actually, that's potentially a nice pivot into something that we wanted to tail off of last week's show. So last week, we continued the discussion again about open source and trying to build a business model around open source technologies and how difficult it can sometimes be to make money there. Well, during the week, or maybe it was at the back end of last week, Martin Mikos...
Who was a news item himself last week on the show.
Indeed he was, with regards to HP, yeah. Well, he gave an interview, I think, to Linux Insider, where he kind of talked around that. Now, you've probably heard enough of my voice for the last 5 minutes, so either of you got an opinion on some of the things that Martin was saying there?
Well, we were speaking about how do you make money out of an open source business model, and the title of this... how should I say, thought leadership post actually is open source is not a business model, and it is so spot on. It is well worth reading. I'm not going to go through it. It's a very good read into what can you and can you not expect if you start a business into open source. The best quote I'm going to get out of it, I'm going to give you the best quote out of the whole blog, and it says, you need to come to terms with the idea that some people will spend any amount of time to save money, which goes to the freeware of open source, but other people will spend money to save time. And that's the philosophical difference between the open source model is to reach people. The business model is not the open source as such. The business model is where you find the people to spend money, and that's where we last week we said, well, anyone that wants to make money out of open source, it's not about converting the people that are using it for free to pay to people that want to pay for it. It's about the services model. It's about the people that want to spend money on services. And it's well written, and it's worth reading.
Yeah, you know, I think it's in the DNA of individuals and the DNA of corporations as well, whether or not they are willing to spend money to save time or spend time to save money. You're in one camp, generally speaking, as an organization, I think. That was a great quote from the article. What I liked as well, which I thought was very interesting, and I think he was citing his experience at MySQL or MySQL, don't expect in the open source world to ever be able to convert customers from the free version into the paying version. I think I'm right in saying that they had something like 15 million users of MySQL, but only 15,000 paying customers.
Which could be more than enough to have a sustainable business.
Oh, yes, it could be, absolutely. But he thought at the beginning of his time there that they'd be able to convert some of those free customers into paying customers. And his opinion afterwards was, generally speaking, that ain't going to happen.
Yep. That's the idea behind the article. That's why it's worth reading and thinking about it for a couple of minutes afterwards.
Yep.
Yeah, it's interesting thinking about the business models around software in general that have to do with open source or low cost for enterprise, right? In the enterprise business, which a lot of our customers are, or a lot of our listeners are. For the most part, the corporations, I think, would rather spend money than spend nothing, right? And it seems a little funny, but I think they want to get the support. They want the throat to choke and all that. You know, if they do something for free, it's a little harder getting the support when everything falls together or falls apart, right?
And even from your own job protection perspective, if you're head of a department or head of a team or something like that, and you don't have a throat to choke and you don't have somebody to point that finger of blame at when things go wrong, then it could be your job on the line in a lot of enterprises, right?
It could. So I think for enterprise software, you know, for the most part, most of those things should convert, which gets back, though, to MySQL. Why not, and maybe not convert, but why so little? I don't really understand that. Were there all those users that were doing it at home in little labs?
Yeah.
It's a huge number. And you look at a company like Nixenta in the storage business, you know, and they're talking about having 6,000 customers or 6,000 users. How many of those have paid for it and how many have not?
Ooh, yeah.
You know, so offline earlier this week, in fact, just yesterday, I was talking to Gabriel, who's not on the show this week, about that. We're trying to figure out, you know, how many customers Nixenta has that have paid for it. And we don't know. It's an interesting thing.
And if you take that MySQL of, and I think those numbers were pretty much right, of 15,000 paying customers based off of 15 million potential users, then, and, you know, the math might not directly apply to Nixenta as well, but that could be just not so many paying customers there. I don't know.
Yeah, I wouldn't translate the math.
No, I'm
MySQL to Nixenta, but I think the ratio is going to be a lot higher from an Nixenta perspective, because you're using this Nixenta. A lot of people use Nixenta as a lab and test, rather than the. I think Nixenta is more into the. To the other aspect of open source that Mikos was trying to address, that is not really open source. It's the premium model, and that's the get it for free to start and upgrade to premium. That's kind of more the area where Nixenta is in, although they have a really good free model. Open source is more towards the distribution of it and getting people to work on the codes. I'm not sure how many people that are working on the code with Nixenta.
Well, it's based on an Illumos kernel, isn't it? So, no offense, probably not very many people then, because I think that's... Well, it's definitely a small community. I don't want to say it's a dying community, but I don't think it's not a vibrant community. It's not like Linux or some of the BSD stuff that's out there.
So, MySQL, it's 15 million or 150 million? What was the number?
15 million. I think it was 15.
Yeah, 15 million users of the product, 15,000 paying customers.
I kind of wonder if that dynamic had been affected by Oracle's acquisition of MySQL and whether or not the paying customers might be higher if Oracle had not acquired it.
Yeah, I'm not sure of what time period he's using the numbers either.
Yeah, it's very interesting. It's staggering to think that, you know, three orders of magnitude, you know, difference between paying and non-paying.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
That's a huge crunch down, if you will. Very interesting.
Cool. Okay, well, let's pivot on to tech news from the week then. So, I don't know here, SanDisk, are they starting to play in the Array game or are they not? I mean, they've announced a couple of products this week, right? IntelliFlash and InfiniFlash. Now, a couple of questions, right? Are they boxed and integrated storage arrays that have been announced? Are they capacity shelves for third-party arrays? What, I mean, are they capacity engines for do-it-yourself, build-your-own, x86-based, software-defined storage solutions? Or are they all of that, or maybe none of it? I don't know.
I haven't really gotten into the real deep details, but what I have seen is that some parts of the products are just shelves and other parts come with some operating system in it that would support Ceph. But then again, there's SaaS connectivity just to other servers. So I haven't really gone into the details. I don't think it's really an array that they're bringing to the market, like, you know, a dual controller array or that type of stuff. I'm not sure it's that.
Is it like JBOD for Flash?
Yes.
It's like JBOD for Flash?
I think so. Wow. That's my best guess for now.
Okay.
Is that a bad business model?
I'm not sure it's a bad business model. I mean, they've got some cool tech that they can slot into that box that others maybe don't have today. I mean, SanDisk does have some cool acquisitions and technology in their belt. They could be building one of the better options on the market to have an all-flash JBOD.
You know, an all-flash JBOD could be an interesting option for a Windows Server.
Right? Oh, there you go.
A lot of Windows Server is sort of designed, you know, all the storage spaces, you know, is supposed to use JBOD, right? So maybe it's intended to go out there and attach to Windows Server, be inexpensive. That would be an interesting tier for a spaces environment, you know, where you could tier data from the SanDisk JBOD to whatever other JBOD you've got. And it's hard to find other JBOD, but you could do it. I mean, that's an interesting idea.
Do you think the Windows operating system could handle that?
Spaces definitely can. If you go and read Jose Barreto's blogs.
Oh, he's a legend, right?
Yeah, he's fantastic. They're hard to read. I mean, you know, I say go read them because I can't.
Oh, no, he's deep.
I've said it before. I really believe in storage spaces and in the storage technologies that Microsoft has built, but I'm not sure. It's probably FUD that I'm throwing out of here. I'm not sure Windows operating system is made to have that all-flash, micro-millisecond type of storage. Just it's an open question.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the InfiniFlash product that they've brought, right, in 3U of rack space, we're talking about half a petabyte of raw flash in 3U. Now, as far as I'm aware, right, from a capacity perspective, a capacity and density, that's market leading, I think. So that's a lot of flash to address there, right?
That's incredible.
Isn't it just?
Half a petabyte?
I know, yeah. And it's MLC as well. So it's not like it's, as far as I'm aware, it's not TLC. Don't quote me on that, but I'm pretty sure it's MLC. Now, they're also, and I say this with a pinch of salt, right? They're quoting 1 million IOPS, though that is at 100% read workload, which is like, okay, fair enough. But now, and I'm not an expert on this, maybe you guys can speak better on this, or if not, we should be calling our friend Enrico Signoretti. But I think in that kind of big data object storage space, workloads probably do tend to be quite heavy on the read side rather than the write side. So I don't know, maybe 1 million IOPS at 100% read. I don't know what that would
what
be.
What were the numbers again? You say half a petabyte of all flash?
Half a petabyte 3U. Of raw flash in 3U.
But this thing's like a black hole. I mean, how dense is it, right? I mean, the gravity must just suck things to it.
So what if I compare these, just top of the head, if you compare these numbers with half a petabyte of all flash, with how many IOPS?
1 million? Well, they're saying a million read IOPS.
You know what?
I think it was at 4K.
That's not a lot of IOPS for that amount of flash.
No, but it's a lot of IOPS. What I was trying to say was it's a lot of IOPS potentially for something like Windows Server to drive.
No, I get that. But 1 million IOPS out of that amount of flash is
not
a lot.
IOPS.
Something else, but, yeah. Something else is creating a huge bottleneck in which you are not using the flash at its full potential. If you only get a million IOPS out of half a petabyte of flash.
Yeah, don't
there's
quote me on
other
this.
Solutions.
Like, maybe it's only got like a single old 3 gig SAS pipe into it or something. I'm sure it doesn't, right? I don't know the details of that.
No, but the connectivity interface is important in understanding this.
Well, probably CPU and internal bandwidth of the box. That's probably going to be somewhere that's going to narrow it down.
But yeah. This is, of the two products announced, we are talking here about the InfiniFlash, which is that deep, dense, not necessarily high performance, certainly not high read performance. Though a million IOPS is still a million IOPS, right?
Read performance is pretty good for analytics. You have to load everything in, but once you've got it in, the jobs that you run are mostly reads.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so maybe it's a potentially good fit there. But talking about its density, right? They're talking about raw here, okay? $2 per gigabyte of raw storage.
I've got the numbers in front of me here.
Okay, right. Says, just let me finish this real quick. If that is the case, right, $2 per gigabyte, that's still $1 million for buying 3 rack units worth of kit. That's still a lot of money.
It's not bad, though. I mean, what is it? It is, but you think about what does it cost you to buy a petabyte of EMC or NetApp? About $1 million.
No, right? I'm just saying, but at least when you buy that, you feel like you've got value for your money because it's taken up like 8 floor tiles.
True that, and it's, yeah. And it comes with a lot of software and all that stuff, right?
It does, yeah. Go on, Hans.
Or it doesn't come with it, but you pay for it.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, I'm just crunching some numbers here, and it even doesn't say a million. It says over 780K.
Which article are you reading? Mine definitely said a million.
Anantech.com.
No, that wasn't where I was. Okay, I don't remember where I was actually.
Does Chris Meller written about it? Because his would be right.
Well, yeah, Chris has written about it as well. But there's a lot of actually tech details in the one that I'm reading here. Okay, never mind. I do have some questions about the use case for. It's weird. It's weird for me to getting not over a million IOPS out of that box with that amount of flash. That's all I got to say about it.
Yeah. The interesting thing for me, though, is really around whether or not somebody like SanDisk really is looking at a long-term play of trying to get into the array business. Because we know that margins there tend to be a lot higher than they are down at the component level. Now, yeah, we're not saying that this is necessarily a foray into the all-flash array market, but is it a precursor to that maybe? Are they testing the water here? Have they built the back end? And then are they looking to build an integrated pair of controllers on the front end, even if it is just running something like Ceph, right? But they could package an object storage product there, potentially, and have a play into the flash array business where margins are higher. I don't know.
Well, yeah, now that you've done, if you present it that way, I would say they would be crazy to try to test the market waters by looking at connecting to Windows Server with Spaces because there's just not that much interest in it. Mm. It would be no market test to do that.
Not much interest in it. You're going to get slated for that again, Mark.
Well, I'm sure I will. There are people interested in doing it, but I don't think there's this lot of pent up demand waiting for it, right?
Yeah.
And you know, if you're going to test yourself against the all flash array market, you can't come into this little niche and prove anything. You gotta go up against other stuff in the market because I mean, something like JBOD and an array, as we all know, are completely different beasts.
Yeah.
Yep.
Cool. So. Enough about storage for the moment. Let's pivot onto some more potentially business news of the week, okay? But with a networking aspect at least. HP are in talks to acquire Aruba Networks, yeah? reportedly looking at shelling out about $3 billion to effectively buy themselves into second spot in the enterprise wireless space. So I've got a bunch of questions around this. And I don't know, HP seem to be, for us on the show at least, a little bit like Microsoft. We rarely have good stuff to say about them.
Well, Gabriel's not on this week. It might be a little more favorable.
That's true, yeah. My first question here, though, is $3 billion, right? This might be a stupid question, but why can't they use some of the 58,000 people that they're going to be letting go to make some of their existing wireless stuff work?
I don't even know how much existing wireless stuff HP has.
Well, they do have, it's called Coribus or something. I forget what its name is, but it doesn't have great market share. And apparently it hasn't had much R&D over the last however many years it's been under the HP umbrella, which is probably not a surprise. But I don't know. Is it an oversimplistic question?
Here's the deal, Nigel. Wireless is... there's one player dominating the market.
Of course, Cisco.
If you want to get in that market and it's not working with what you have, what do? You buy the runner-up. That's exactly what HP did. And they bought a really good, one of the better Wi-Fi players in the market. It's comparable to Dell buying Force 10. They bought one of the best 10 gig players in the market. I'm not sure how much Dell had done with it since then, but... this is HP buying the runner-up with a very good wireless technology. Being at HP and being that they are quite busy on the networking side of their business, I have good hopes for this. There's a couple of things on the other side, other than HP, that Aruba today is a big OEM player.
And oh, yeah.
That might be an issue. There was Tom Hollingsworth, networking nerd on Twitter, networkingnerd.net is his blog. He wrote a blog post about the HP buying Aruba, and he said that, and let me say, it's Dell, Juniper, Brocade, Alcatel-Lucent, and many others are OEMs of Aruba. That is going to hurt. Because if everyone else is using that technology and HP is now snagging that away, that's going to hurt number 3, 4, 5, 7, and 8.
Yeah, I agree. So that brings up another potentially noddy but interesting question, I think. What does HP do with those OEM relationships? I mean, is it just the natural thing to say, right, we're going to cut them loose and we're going to shaft over Brocade and Dell and Juniper and company? Or can they say, well, you know what? Those companies would be in a really quite an awkward situation if we were to cut off that OEM deal. So let's push the OEM fees up a bit here and milk them for as much as we can for as long as we can.
Nope.
No, why not?
Nope. Yeah, I don't think they do it either.
And there's a couple of historical examples. Maybe the Clarion is one of them, that Dell OEM, that as soon as Dell went on with their more products, they quit selling that. They were done with it. It happens more when these deals happen. It dies off. The OEM partnership dies off. Right now, Dell, Juniper, Brocade, and the others, they will just stop selling Aruba. They're not going to give...
Oh, no. I'm not convinced of that at all. I think Dell will. I'm not sure that the rest of them need to.
Sorry, Mark. Dell will continue or will stop.
No, Dell will, oh, no. Dell will stop.
Dell right. will definitely stop. Dell is not going to give one penny to HP.
But, I mean, historically, HP has been an OEM provider to all kinds of companies on all kinds of technologies. And I think they can continue to keep that with everybody except, you know, their big competitor, Dell.
Okay, so this is bad news, though, for Dell, right? They're in a pickle if this deal goes through. I mean, not a massive pickle, right? It's wireless, and don't get me wrong, I appreciate that that's a big market with a lot of customers out there. But is this not the danger that you always go into when you go into the OEM business? That today you're in a customer and you're telling them how awesome this technology is that you're OEMing. Tomorrow it gets bought by a competitor, so you have to go visit them again the day after and say, you know what? That really awesome technology we told you about the other day, it's not so good anymore, and we've got something different. I mean, that's...
Yeah, let's think through this, though, Nigel, right?
So you're going to see Dell acquiring.
Well, maybe, but let's think through this. So, what is the hurt to Dell? HP could say we're going to charge you more, and Dell could say this is going to contribute to HP's bottom line if we sell it. And that's the biggest problem, is Dell will say we're contributing to HP's profit. But if Dell needs a product to sell, and if they sell those products and it doesn't give HP any advantage selling into those accounts, right, if there's not some interlock between, HP servers, running on Aruba technology that Dell would have to deal with in their accounts, they can probably live with that for a while till they figure something else out.
Right, yeah. So give themselves some breathing space at least.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I think Dell will just stop selling as of now immediately anything that has to do with that, as far as it's not already shipping and sold, and I can see Michael Dell making another acquisition very soon.
With what?
I don't know. Something they can offer.
Yeah, well, that's interesting, right? Because Dell now is a private company, and they were heavily leveraged. It's not like they have a lot of money to spend, right? So Dell may say, you know what, we can live with this, because if we're going to acquire someone else, it's going to really take a lot of cash that maybe they have, maybe they don't. And if they don't have it, they'll probably just have to deal with, the Aruba product from HP. And, it's not the worst thing. If they've got a lot of customers, they have to continue to support them. They need to do that. They're going to support them anyway, whether they cut them off or not. The customer that just bought a Dell wireless system that has Aruba technology in it, buys that knowing that it's going to be supported for some amount of time. Dell's not going to say to those customers, we're not going to support you anymore. Of course, they have to. So it's kind of a hard place for Dell here. But my guess is that, cooler heads will prevail, and they'll buy the technology from HP. And as long as HP doesn't undermine Dell's accounts with that technology, and it's not clear to me that they can, Dell can sell it and they can be happy, with that. Or they can be satisfied with it, but maybe not happy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not sure I see that happening, but I get your point.
Yeah, they might not have cash. They might not have an option.
Yeah, but I mean, if they don't have enough cash for an acquisition, I'd rather see them. I think I'll see them going on another OEM first before selling more Aruba into HP's pockets.
This is one of the problems of taking a public company private. Huh. When you take it with a public company, you have stock to trade. And so they could do a deal with someone else in a stock swap. They can't do that.
Yeah, that's right.
If they don't have cash and they don't have stock, what are they gonna buy something with?
Mm-hmm. Well, but that's my next point if it's not an acquisition, it's going to be a new partnership. I'm setting my bets on that.
I just think that this whole we can't OEM anymore just because it's HP, right? And we're mortal enemies with HP or whatever that is. Great and all, but that sucks for your customers. You are not looking out for your customers with that attitude. Now, it's sheer speculation here. None of us really knows what's going to happen. I just think you're shafting your customers over if you take that kind of attitude. Well, we're Dell and they're HP, and therefore we just can't do it. Pfft. Sack that. Think about your customers.
Sadly, that's how it's done.
I know. Last question on this. Are things like what happens to existing OEM agreements and support for, Dell sold versions of this, is that stuff all cut and baked into the acquisition deal? Are all the terms and conditions around that part of the deal?
That's always part of the deal. I remember that when Dell stopped selling the CX, actually EMC boxes, we got support from EMC on those boxes. So it's usually cooked and baked into the deal. What they are going to charge you for anything extra, that's another question, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Oracle didn't buy them.
Not that bad then.
Yeah. Not that bad. It is an interesting move by HP. I think the bigger question is, do they pay too much?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know the wireless.
An acquisition of 11% of the market, and it's not bad. It's a bigger market share than 3PAR had.
Yep. It's a lot of money, but maybe it makes sense. I'm not a networking guy, especially not a wireless networking guy.
Hey, can I take a really positive spin on this, right? I mean, so it's got to be as long as you're not one of the 58,000, okay? But it's got to be a potentially exciting time for HP, right? They're about to split the business, so there's interesting stuff going on there. And they are putting cash behind the networking business, right? We were only just talking about them, was it last week? On the networking front, here they are again shelling out another $3 billion. Appreciate it's not core switching and stuff here. This is wireless networking, what have you. But still, the networking business at HP, I mean, they're doing some stuff there, right?
Yep, they are. Yeah, yep. So the new infrastructure, you know, part of HP has a very good product line to sell. And, you know, the other part of this is they may have access into a, you know, it's hard to think that HP doesn't have access into any corporate accounts. So there's probably not an element to that. The Aruba technology being there may help them, you know, with their relationships as this new company, you know, this sort of new company from HP starts its business.
Yeah. And wireless, I mean, wireless still has a lot of ways to go in a lot of enterprise companies.
There's more money to be made out of that market
for the next
few years.
There's a lot of money still to be made out of wireless.
Has Greg Farrow said anything about this?
Not sure.
Yeah, I don't know.
We should check that out. Yeah.
He probably has.
Yeah, we should check that out. Anyway, maybe next week, because he's always got something really interesting to say. He likes to grind on Cisco, so maybe he likes this.
So one last thing for the show then, Western Digital or HGST to acquire your neighbor's hands. Mm-hmm. I think it's only right that you should lead out on this one.
Absolutely. Hear, hear.
No, it's AmpliData is one of the object storage players. And yes, is a company from Belgium.
Hey.
Just got acquired by HGST.
They got pulled over and thrown in jail by HGST.
Well, what comes out of this, and besides the deal as such, because the deal is not disclosed and it's not going to be disclosed because I asked a couple of the investors, is if you look at what HGST is originally just spinning disk company, and what they have been acquiring in the last couple of years is that they've first bought Estec and Viridant.
Flash guys, yeah.
Yeah, so two flash companies, with Viridant being a fierce competitor of Fusion.io back then in those type of cards. They bought Skyera in December, which is an all-flash box. Now they bought AmpliData as active archiving or big object storage. I mean, the only thing they're missing is an all-purpose array if you got another storage company here.
And you know what? If Hitachi hadn't flogged them off to Western Digital, they would have that under the umbrella of HDS.
Well,
we don't need to talk about that, but
HDS has their own plays. But I see just a new storage company rising from just a manufacturer, actually, originally a manufacturer of hard disks.
Again, very similar to what we were saying earlier about SanDisk, yeah?
Yep, exactly.
I thought it was a very interesting buy by HGST, and I'm trying to look it up right now. One of the ESG analysts actually wrote a really nice piece on it. I thought it was a good analysis. It's very interesting watching HGST on this, right? And it's similar to like SanDisk building arrays. You know, now you've got HGST building out, you know, private cloud storage options. High speed with Skyera and massive capacity with AmpliData. Yeah. Congratulations to everybody at AmpliData, I think. Right, the numbers weren't announced, and the last investor in AmpliData was HGST.
Yes, exactly. I was going to bring it up.
For about $10 million last year.
Yeah.
So they were heavily leveraged, and it may be that it's not the happy ending that everybody was wanting there, but and it may be. I don't know.
It is, because I called the CTO this afternoon, and he said one of the reasons we made the deal and It surprised me is that I asked him, I said, look, are they now going to consolidate R&D in the Valley, or are you going to stay here with a couple of R&D people? And he said, no, we're actually going to move more R&D to Belgium. They're going to expand the R&D in Belgium as such. Because one of the reasons for HGST to make the deal is that it's very hard to find decent talent now in the Valley to expand this type of business, because there's so many storage startups already out there. It's very hard to find the right talent.
It's hard to hire in the Valley right now.
It's hard to hire in the Valley, especially in storage. And AmpliData has shown that the people they have on board stay on board longer than average, and they want to test that out and going to expand the R&D here in Belgium. So that surprised me, but I'm very happy about that. That not only we have an exit, but we also have an expansion of that business here locally.
Yeah, and so the exit is good for the venture business in Belgium too. So congratulations on that front. I think the investors will be making some money, and maybe they can turn that into other technology in Belgium. So congrats to everybody over there. Yep. I think it looks like a really cool thing.
Excellent stuff. Guys, again, long show. Do we have anything else before we wrap it up?
Nah, we're cool.
Okay, then we'll wrap this up with a Captain Dogger episode. And you'll need your OpenStack hat on to follow along with all of the OpenStack lingo that Captain Dogger throws into this one.
Captain's log entry. Captain Dogger of the HMS Containerizer. Just completed a week at sea with our sister ship, HMS Rocket. Finished an experimental mission. Both ships and crews were to compete with each other in devising a system to get containers into the cloud. Strange challenge indeed. I mean, containers in the clouds. What be the point of it all? Anyway, each ship set sail with a complement of 30 containers, and we sails north to where the cloud level is lower and there normally be more clouds. At 66 degrees north, we drops anchor and starts the challenge. Now our sister ship HMS Rocket seem to have the same idea as us. Stack up their containers on top of each other and hopefully reach the cloud level. But they was quicker than us at building their stack, which they was calling Cloud Stack on account of them trying to stack them as high as the clouds. And they be about 15 containers high when the winds whipped up and disaster struck. Those winds blew that cloud stack down, and they be mighty lucky not to have taken more damage than they did. Now, like I says, we's not so quick as they, so we's able to learn from their misfortune. And an ingenious idea we had. You see, we'd open the doors at each end of our containers we was stacking, so that any winds would blow right through. And of course, we named ours the Open Stack, on account of the doors being open. Now, just last night we was camped out in the bottom container of our open stack. And I tell you, once the fire were out and the cinders all burned out, well, we'd no heat and it were like an ice house in there. But we camped the whole night anyway. Now, by pure chance, I happens to take a swift glance at the horizon and sees me a bright light in the sky. I imagines a super nova of maybe an old neutron star. Anyway, morning arrives. Arr, and it be full of sweet, sweet, low-lying cloud. and we's all a full of merriin' and excitement. For there in front of our eyes, we's got containers in the clouds. Mission accomplished. Aye, and what better way to celebrate victory and success than with cigars? So I orders the chef to go fetch a kilo of Havana cigars. And we smoke those cigars watching a puppet show. Arr, sweet, sweet success. End of log entry.